Hi, good morning. My name is Marcus. I work with SUSE, and today I would like to introduce you to the work of our security team, our security work, what challenges we face, and what interesting things have happened in the last years. So if you are an OpenSUSE community member or a SUSE employee, let me briefly introduce the team that I work in. So these are all SUSE employees. Our team lead currently is Andreas Stieger. He has been a project manager before, but as our previous team lead left the company, he's now taking on this role. There's one project manager, that's me currently, responsible for the reactive work. I'm writing the plural here because we will also likely hire a new project manager in the near future for proactive work again. There are some security engineers you will be reading about them in our Bugzilla and by emails like Alexander Bergmann, Johannes Segitz, Karol Babioch, Matthias Gerstner and Victor Pereira. And we also currently have one working student working for us on working on a thesis on security in software-defined networks. His name is Alexandros and he's somewhere around the Greek mafia that hangs around the conference. Ah, there he is. We have some open positions to fill because SUSE is growing, so we are looking for security engineers and also soon for a new project manager. So what do we do? We do proactive work. Proactive work means making the distribution, the product secure before shipping, and we do reactive work, meaning reacting on security issues, responding to incidents, resolving them, releasing updates, and so on. At some point in time, 1.5, 2 years ago, we decided to split those responsibilities because our team has grown and the number of issues has grown. So Alex, Johannes, Victor, Karol, and myself work in the reactive side of things. We still work also on product security, but mostly we are responsible for the response. And on the proactive side, where we do auditing, releases, approval, there currently we have Andreas and Matthias, but we are still looking for people in that area to build up. So what do we do? What is reactive security? What do we do for reactive security? So basically we need to track and react on all security incidents, issues reported to us that exist in our products. I will go on the numbers a bit later on. For that, in our sub-team, we have so-called incident update managers so that everyone is aware of what he has to do. Basically, something really like in regular ticket handling, we mirror that also for the security incidents. So we have a so-called incident and update managers in a rotating role, so everyone knows when to take care of it or who takes care of what. What we do as a security team, we coordinate, we don't fix it ourselves. So coordination means we put the incidents into our tracking systems, then hand over the work of fixing to our packagers. They can of course come back to us, ask questions, get help, or we help them with patches and so on. But basically we rely on our package maintainers all across SUSE or the OpenSUSE community to fix the bugs, submit them back to us. The source review is done by the OBS review team externally and by the internal build service reviewers internally. And for the testing itself, we give back our updates to the maintenance, so-called maintenance QR that tests these updates. Internally, we have currently 3 teams testing. Externally, we have mostly rely on OpenQA doing the testing. Internally, we also rely on the OpenQA automated testing framework. But externally, we largely rely on the OpenQA framework and some community members that test the current updates. We take care of the release of the updates, of course, and of documentation. Most of the documentation is automated, but occasionally we need some additional manual documentation with more information, more technical hints and workarounds to handle. So for incidents that come in, every incident that affects our software gets a bug in our Bugzilla. You can look at it. All of those are public or will get public after the embargo ends. You will notice them if you look at the summary line for the val dash prefix and the CE number and the package name. It's in the summary. References, descriptions, links are all in the regular bug slug comments. And those bugs, as said, be assigned to the package or bug owner. So it's kind of important. If you are a bug owner of a package, you will likely get assigned these bugs, and then we rely on you on reacting on that. Internally, we use a ticket system that manages the real flow of the incidents. We call it SMASH. I don't even remember anymore what the abbreviation stands for. But it does additional things that Bugzilla does not provide. So we rate the incidents. So basically, we have simplified rating of low, moderate, critical, important. And we have a CVSS version 3 scoring, common vulnerability scoring system that is used by us and by our customers and users to evaluate how large the impact is of a security issue. So some standards say install all security fixes that has a CVSS rating larger than 4 or larger than 6 or something like that. So it's a service we deliver also for our customers that we score every issue with this kind of rating. Internally, as we have a lot of different code streams internally, we track the affectedness. So if something is affected, something is not affected. It's not really that necessary for OpenSUSE Leap and Tumbleweed because these are quite fresh. And for Leap, we have currently 2 code streams, but usually 1 code stream. So usually the software is affected in Leap or Tumbleweed and will get fixes. Internally, where we have a software that is 10 years old, it's not always clear if it's affected or not, and to keep track of that, we use that tool. It's also used for planning and starting updates, so mostly to not lose anything, to not lose sight of the number of bugs that inside. So how has the number of bugs developed over the last years? So I have a Bugzilla query that checks every week on how many bugs were opened in that week, and it's running since 2006. And you see that up to the middle, which is around 2013, there were around, it's probably not readable, but around 10 to 12 bugs open per week, and it's accepting some noise, it stayed at that rate. And starting with 2013, the rate is growing, and now we are currently with a lot of noise inside around a rate of 30 bugs per week. Why this change? The change is that Linux got more attention on from security researchers. A lot of more people look at it and see find bugs inside. But mostly this is also coming from automated bug finding. The automated bug finding is usually done is either with static code checkers or with fuzzing. And a lot of those come out of the fuzzing tools. Notably, there's a tool called American Fuzzy Lob that really is easy to use, easy to plug in into your program. And if the code base has not seen any kind of fuzzing and isn't written in a safe language, which unfortunately most of them are, it will find quite a number of bugs very easily. So I will go on some details later on, but Image Magic is our all-time favorite in that. So to handle that, before we didn't really have that much of a ticket system. We had some tools that helped us, but with a number of occasionally 100 bugs per week, it's very hard to lose, not to lose track of things. So we've written this internal ticketing system called SMASH, and basically, it gives us all the new issues that we don't know about, and we go over them, we analyze all issues, open bug reports, track the affected software and the ratings, and then defer this, delegate the work of fixing it to the packages. So how does the update submissions work? The packager submits the update, and the security team puts some metadata on it, additionally to it, the summary, the description and the issues in a machine-readable format. So basically keeping the same style over our documentation that is then generated, because out of that, the automated emails are generated and update notices and so on are generated. We check if it's good, if it's building, if some standard checks run on it, and then forward it to our QA. QA is both manual and automated, so we have quite a lot of checkers these days. We have open QA, and our QA itself tests still the they test bug fix verification and, if not yet automated, regression testing. The end, we release the update and do potentially additional documentation work if not done automatically. So also for the update submissions, we have a tool that makes us not lose track. So basically listing what is submitted, what is currently prepared, what is in testing. So here I have the tab open that is used by our QA department that looks at what incidents are the next for testing. They are prioritized, classified, and so on. So without this kind of tooling, it would not work anymore. Sorry. What do we deliver? We deliver the updates, of course, and a lot of compliance, checking, users, they get emails, email notifications. We present them either as email archive update, email archive, or we have a web page where you can even search or click on them under this URL. We generate machine-readable advisory data. That's called CVRF, Common Vulnerability Reporting Format. It doesn't have so many external tools yet. There's a Python module that uses it that you can hook into your applications. So it's only taking off a bit right now. And we also auto-generate information based on a per CVE ID. So you can look at pages for every CVE ID that we fixed and see what is the rating, what is affected, what is not affected. So basically everything that we worked inside is exposed to the outside in a human-readable format, but also in a machine-readable format. The machine-readable format is in so-called OVLAN, Open Vulnerability Assessment Language format. This is part of the so-called SCAP, Security Content Automation Protocol format suite, and can be feed into the OpenSCAP utility or other OVL processing utilities to find automatically if your system is still affected by a CVE or not. That's very helpful if you manage hundreds or thousands of machines, for instance. So some of the statistics, I took the full year 2017, so I'm not looking at the last 6 months, but at the full year 2017. Overall, we processed over 3,000 CVEs, declaring them as affected or not affected. We opened 2,500 bugs, which the number really surprised me already. I would have thought like 1,000 or so, but it really was 2,500. Out of that, I took the highlights. The highlights were, we have 266 kernel issues. The kernel itself also gets fuzzing, so more things are get also found in the kernel. As I mentioned, image matching and graphics matching are really outliers on the number of issues found, mostly because they implement a lot of codecs. It's quite old software where people programmed without security in mind at that time. The good thing is, both are improving. Graphics Magic is already based on a better consistency model than Image Magic, and both are continuously improving, so less and less bugs are found anymore. Mozilla Firefox, here I counted the total number of CVEs. It's a high attention code base, so a lot of issues are still found in it. TIFF and Wireshark also got a lot of reports from fuzzing. Yeah, and there's a long list that has less bugs opened. We released 1,000 security updates for the enterprise product code lines, and we released 626 for OpenSUSE in 2017. And this OpenSUSE leap is inheriting a lot of packages from SLE. I also looked at the number, what of those were SLE imports. There were 250 updates directly imported from SLE. So one third of the security fixes for Leap automatically came from our SUSE Linux Enterprise code base and did not need any OpenSUSE community attention. What is not counted here is that also the kernel, the same Git tree is used also for Leap 42.3 as for SLE 12 SP3. So the kernel itself is also coming from SLE, but not listed separately here. And in the end, we fixed altogether 2,300 CVEs in 2017. So without any tooling, this is quite impossible, and it's really getting really a pipelining feel, so a factory pipeline feel, like a car pipeline or something like that. So I don't really know anymore what bugs I opened last week. So was there an image magic bug? I don't know. So, but some bugs shine out of that. Some bugs get more attention than others, and we classified those as high-impact vulnerabilities. So what are? So this is a name that we invented. Why are these high-impact vulnerabilities? Not just because they get a lot of attention, but they are high-impact, so like Worms could exploit them. It's trivial, exploitable, with a root exploit. Or they really cause a lot of customer queries because they are difficult to fix, they need some workarounds or something like that. So everything that stands out, that needs special attention, that needs also special reaction times, we classify as so-called high-impact vulnerabilities and handle them with more attention, with more manual work, with more manual documentation on top. Yeah, the code names are probably familiar to you. Heartbleed and Shellshock started that that trend with codename vulnerabilities, and coming up to Meltdown and Spectre beginning of this year. So let me tell you about some of those. So the Stacklash, you probably forgot about it already. That was 1 year ago. The issue was not that something was buggy. So the programs were okay. They were working as intended. The code was okay. The kernel was okay. But there was a flaw in the Linux memory management model. So basically, everything exists in the same address space. And most of the data that is allocated grows upwards, except the stack. The stack grows downwards. So researchers found here, what if those happen to collide? So this is something that was found even earlier. Last time was in 2010, that people could exploit it. And in 2010, they thought, yeah, we do one page. We do a little bit of buffer between that one page. So no one will cross that buffer, and that protects that both address spaces collide. And last year, a security research company, Qualys, found that there are places in common code where more than this one page, this 4 kilobyte, can be jumped over, so that really you could crash stuff together again. And sadly, one of those places was in glibc. In glibc, even before the program starts, glibc does some of those allocations, those on-stack allocations for LD audit, LD library path, and similar things. So it was even exploitable without actually starting the program. So you just took a setuid program, and during starting, glibc was in the start routines already causing an exploitable problem. Yeah, this was kind of hard. It's definitely something that is called a high impact vulnerability because it was quite easy to exploit. But it was kind of hard to fix. So foremost, the kernel received a bigger band aid gap. So currently up to now, it was 4 kilobyte, and now it's 1 megabyte or 2 megabytes. It can also be configured now. So if you want to save address space, then you can have a smaller gap if you trust the code. So that killed most of the attacks, but it did not remove the underlying problem actually. So what was additionally added is that GCC now gets code where on such stack allocations that are done by the compiler, it touches every page during this allocation, and so causes a fault if if someone jumps over more than 4 kilobyte or more than 8 kilobyte pages. And as we changed this in GCC, we had to actually rebuild all the packages. It's a bit tricky. We don't really want to do that for released code streams. But what we did is that at least for C12 and OpenSUSE Leap 42.3, we enabled that. Also for the updates and all updates that we have released since then have this feature enabled and are built with this compiler feature. And interesting enough, after fixing the kernel, most of the security researcher community lost interest in that topic. It's just that to avoid finding it again in a year or two, we now switched our distribution to use this compiler option and to avoid this problem altogether. Yeah, and Spectre and Meltdown was released beginning of January this year. So side channel attacks are not new. I learned about this in university in the 90s. Side channel attacks using speculative executions is, however, quite a new concept. That was really brought up in the last year, and researchers are now looking deeply into that topic. So while we have seen some of the issues in beginning of January and one other issue just last week, there will likely be more issues coming up because researchers are now looking at it, and with kind of a run through of like half a year, we will like see every half year or also we will see probably new issues. The concept is, or the basic problem is that the CPUs speculative execute following instructions to make more out of parallelism or make it more parallel to be faster and quicker. And they take shortcuts during that. So because every correct execution would cost a lot of transistors, die space, and so they take shortcuts. And almost all of these shortcuts can cause these side channel attacks. So, for instance, if you look at Meltdown, the main problem is the lack of access control on a supervisor bit of the page table entries. So the speculative engine did not look at the supervisor bit. So it accessed page tables, page table entries or memory, even though it was not able or should not have been able to access it. It was a shortcut taken to make it faster, to have less transistors, but it caused this kind of security issue. And the general part is that the speculative execution fetches stuff into caches is probably kind of unavoidable to just gain the speed or keep the speed. So we will probably always see some kind of cache-based side channel attacks in this area. What were our problems here? There have been strict embargoes on it for several months. Intel itself took like half a year. We were involved since November, around end of November on that. And our engineers were involved around October. So they were working on it since around October until January. It's not a software bug. The software is fine. But we need software workarounds because we cannot replace all processors in the field. And some of those need CPU microcode changes. Especially this speculative bound jump prediction violation that variant 2 was needed some microcode changes to flush the prediction buffers. As these need software workarounds, the patches are not straightforward. So usually a security fix in software is called by, like Oliver said this morning, I just need to add an if somewhere. So usually the security fixes are 2-liners, 4-liners, or something like that, but this really needed a massive effort. Hundreds of lines of code in tricky code paths, like the system call, entry path, assembler, with also high risk of causing regressions. And the one thing is that the fixes lose performance. So, and customers, while customers you want security, they also want performance. And the priorities for my team is, of course, we want security. But the customers, they are kind of pissed if their compute job takes half an hour longer. or performance drops by 20%. So that caused quite some feedback rounds, and after it gets got public, we fortunately people found for some of the problems faster equivalent of fixing it. So the variant one, while at the beginning there were fencing that stopped all the speculative execution. Now they use a different code, not an if construct, but more a masking. So an end operation on a checks that allows the speculation to continue and so gives back some of the performance again. So about the details. So currently we have four spectre variants, or basically four. Meltdown is variant three, so but usually the name is Meltdown there, and there the issue we fixed fully on the first release using the page table isolation, meaning that the user space and the kernel address space are separate and flipped on, flipped off on transitioning from kernel to user land. The good thing is that it's really, there's one issue that is the problem and we have one fix for it. So there's no confusion, is something not fixed or is there still a partial fix missing? This is different for the variant one of Spectre. That is basically, we can see it as a new bug class. So if you're familiar with it, if construct, so if and speculative execution on secret data, public data, that can happen in a lot of places of code, and the compiler cannot easily detect it. So Microsoft has done some work on changing their C compiler to detect such patterns and emit respective boundaries, fencing in there. For GCC, that is not yet done. So basically, you have to look at a lot of code and see if it needs a fence there or not. So we are still at upstream, and we are still poking, fixing the variant one issue in all the various places where it happens throughout the kernel. The variant two was with the jump buffer misprediction. There the problem is, the good thing is that it only is interesting if you transition from privileged to unprivileged or unprivileged to privileged code. So we put, so the kernel itself is built now with so-called redpoolean, so no, the kernel has no such gadgets where this can happen anymore. And the microcode helps flushing it once we transition between virtual machines. So that can be considered mostly or largely fixed. And variant four that was released last week, the speculative memory disambiguation that really needs from Intel microcode fixes to really fix it, because it's not easily fixable with software. Our software just enables the fixing and allows switching on and off the changes. Yeah, let's see what the future will bring on that. There are likely more of those. So this is something. So this is the fun, the parts that the reactive team has. So the not fun part is the massive amount. The more fun parts are these. What we do, however, for proactive security, like making the product secure before we go to shipment. We follow a so-called secure development lifecycle. It's not formalized internally yet, but it's something that we are working on. We have quite some mechanisms in place already for doing that. We have automated checks during build. So our build service runs after building the RPM various scripts that looks for security binaries, deboot services, policy kit rules, PAM modules, everything that can cause the user land to root, user to root transition, and looks into our whitelists if they are have been seen by us and have been whitelisted. If they have not been whitelisted, they will abort the build, and the error message will say, please contact the security team for whitelisting the service. So basically then the packager can open a bug report, we will look at the code, we will tell him, yeah, there are bugs in there, fix them first, and then we in a discussion with the packager, we can agree on how to fix it or how to, if to enable it or not. Yeah, we also look at things that are security relevant that are not easily catchable by build checks, like network services or other system services that could take a look at. Our audits are rolling as same as Tumbleweed. So the same way Tumbleweed rolls, we see breakage, we address the breakage. So we are not going, when the product is being shipped, we have not a milestone in Ludwig's plan that says a security audit on the 1st of April. No, we work all year long on these kind of audits. So, and as Ludwig takes, the OpenSUSE Leap development takes from OpenSUSE Tumbleweed, they see the audited packages, the approved packages from our work over time. But we do look at the final product to see if something was enabled that should not have been enabled, like we scan for the open network ports and look at the system services running. So if something has escaped our eyes so far. And so the work in Tumbleweed is definitely benefiting our work in SLE. So for SLE, we don't have that many additional things to review. We have all reviewed them in Tumbleweed before. To give you a bit of a number that we kind of handled 80 audit, or we opened at least 80 audit requests in 2017, and that number seems to be increasing over time. One thing is also where I was part of it, the activation of, for instance, new compiler flex. For StackClash, we needed a new compiler flex for the C compiler, minus F stack, minus clash, minus protection. And I needed to enable it in Tumbleweed. And in Tumbleweed, any change that you do needs to pass staging, because you cannot just enable something and half the thing breaks and no one can fix it. So I got a staging project. I had the RPM opflex changed to include it. And then I went and fixed all the bugs that were inside. Fortunately, for StackClash protection, were one or two at most. So it was a very low number. And once I convinced that this is a good thing and once OpenQA is run, I basically told the OpenSUSE factory chief, Dominic, to add this option also to the regular factory opflex. That was it. So that, fortunately, the StackClash protection was an easy transition. Also, we changed stack protector mode, the heuristics with stack canaries, from default to the strong mode, which brings a bit more, which protects some more functions. It was similar, easy, but also done via staging. And there I had to fix some packages that stripped out minus F stack protector with Z from the opflex and that didn't know that there could be a F stack protector minus strong. So all, again, like 5 to 10 packages I had to fix. And then fortunately no compile problems or no OpenQA problems, and it also went into the distribution. One of the last year's project that was finished last year is the position independent executable support. Up to then we had only some of the packages were built with that, mostly the setuid packages. And the question was if we can enable the distribution wide. So there were some challenges on that. One challenge is convincing people it doesn't lose performance. Because on x86 32-bit, it uses one register more to enable that, the EBX, the BX register. And so the compiled binaries will be slower for an unknown amount. But fortunately, as most of the distributions that we currently provide are 64-bit, an additional register usage is not so important anymore, and our measurements that we took only short low-digit numbers of percentage problems, like 1% or even less. So the allowance on the performance side was taken, and enabling that in a distribution is a bit tricky. It's not just a C flag for the C compiler, but it's also a linker flag. Yeah, while previous approaches, where we just changed the optimization flex, and all our packages use those from the global setting, it was not so easy to do this for the position-independent executable support. I did a bit of research and lots of discussion with our compiler team, and first I said, let's change the compiler to do this by default. This did not while the compiler guys liked it, the distribution integrators didn't like it. So that was a method that I couldn't go. Then we found the idea of doing a compiler wrapper, a GCC wrapper, but it was also too ugly for some people. And what we are doing now is there's a compiler default setting file, configuration file that can be plugged into the system. And we have one RPM package that just provides this default file. And that puts the PI options into the linker and compiler flex if no other conditions, if some conditions are met. And once you install this package called gcc-py, your compiler will automatically generate PI binaries. So having this package, getting the project config set so that it gets default installed was the way to enable it. And then I looked at the fallout, and there were like, I think, 50 packages or so that needed attention. So mostly packages that build static binaries that were not able to link those position-independent executables. For instance, Xen builds some BIOS images, but I really wanted to build Xen with PI, but it builds some PI some BIOS images, some deep in their makefile chain. So I can say that we now compile like 99.something% of packages with position-independent support. Some of those we don't, but these are quite well documented, and if people want to build them with PI support, they can approach that. Takeaway from this, even security has to go through the staging process, and occasionally it's easy, occasionally it's, however, a bit harder. Yeah, so we, our proactive security guys, they also do audits for non-distribution products. So the enterprise distribution is not the only thing that we do these days. We do cloud based on OpenStack. We use storage. There have been some Ceph talks where you got told about this yesterday. We have SUSE Manager and also some container stack-based products these days. These are not terrestrial distributions. They are quite large frameworks of lots of components interacting, and all these component interaction, of course, can cause security issues. So this is something that we are also looking at, where we also give security feedback and look at it, basically. There we also embedded one of our engineers in the product development team, because they work in an agile fashion, and in an agile fashion, the participation is kind of important, so someone from the outside will not be able to be effective working with them. So we loaned one of our engineers for half a year into this development team, and he established code scanning in their continuous integration pipelines and similar things. As we are building up more stuff, we can do that more often with the new products that we ship. Yeah, and that's it, basically. We have a landing page for all our resources on our website, where all the machine-readable data, the human-readable information, and our contact information is displayed. Our main contact address is security@suse.de. And if you have a question on security topics, feel free to ask me here at the conference or by email. Yeah, just feel free. Questions?
It works a bit, just speak better.
Short question regarding
something, like not the security of the system, but the security more related for the users. Because now I think the security in the way that something can reach the root level is quite good. But what about some sandboxing or something? Like if the user accidentally starts some malicious binary, how to minimize the damage?
Yeah, so we don't have done any specifics on that. So for the web browsers, we rely on the upstream work from, say, Chromium, from, say, Firefox that do their sandboxing now. We currently have not been set up to develop this on our own. So we tried several years ago to do a form of app armor protection of user space programs, but as they are very flexible in their actions, it was kind of hard to confine them. So, but fortunately, as I said, the Chromium web browser is with their sandboxing models already quite advanced. We rely on the user, on the programs that we use, that they do that already. We are of course looking at such methods like, we'll see if we do some more S-Linux support or something like that, but so far we are not doing anything on our own on that topic.
So there was a lot of work to address Spectre in the kernel. Is there need to do a work in user space, like X server and such stuff?
It's tricky. So for user space, interesting are parts where you have untrusted code running that can be controlled by an attacker. So for instance, the JavaScript engines. And the JavaScript engines were actually affected by that because they have high resolution timers and they have some form of direct memory access, so they could get at the cache timing, they could get cache-based timings. And what WebScript, Chrome, and Firefox did, they made this high precision timer from JavaScript less precise and they disabled access to these kind of direct memory access pipelines. So if you have sandbox code, just in time compiled or something, then this is possible that such speculative problems can be exploited also in user land. So just yesterday we got a notice here, we should probably compile OpenSSH with it, and I thought, yeah, that sounds weird. But then I remembered that OpenSSH has already strict sandboxing of their network handling, their PAM handling, and so on. And if you can break out of those sandboxes, would also be bad. So if you can assume that an attacker can access this network sandbox, and with this Spectre attack, he could read at least memory out of other sandboxes, out of other processes of SSH, and it would be unfortunate. So while most userland programs don't need it because they just don't run untrusted or they are not called by untrusted code, we need to really take a look at the sandboxes and see if we need to protect them in any form. So yes, basically.
Is this problem even for such like X server where it runs root and communicates with untrusted applications on user or something?
The idea is to have specific code patterns that you follow, and that's kind of hard for the X server. I don't. One thing we should think about is that these 3D engines, they have this shader language, again, a language. Yeah, so we probably should think about how the shader language can probably be used to speculative execute or to translate when it is translated into CPU machine code, and that could be misused. But it's a research topic which still has a lot of potential of new research. Yeah. More questions? Okay, then thank you and talk to you later.